Hey y'all, welcome back to Manual Therapy Blog. It's me, Matt Thomason, here to bring you another interview in our series. Today we get to speak with Bob Rowe. If you are a member of the APTA or a member of the AAOMPT, you probably have heard of Bob before. For the APTA, he is on the board of directors, and at least for the AAOMPT, he's a past president, as well as probably serving in a number of other roles with either of those organizations. Also, he is the director of the Brooks Institute of Higher Learning in Jacksonville, Florida. And to round out a number of different things about Bob, he has been the recipient of the Lucy Blair Service Award from the APTA, the Award for Excellence in Research, Education, Patient Care, and Community Outreach from the Louisiana State University Health Science Center, and a recipient of the Dave Warner Distinguished Service Award from the Louisiana Physical Therapy Association. So Bob's pretty involved with a number of different things within our profession in terms of leadership roles, as well as education. I've met Bob personally a couple of times at conference, and he is absolutely, without a doubt, a super nice guy. He's willing to help anyone and everyone that comes across his path, and I think anybody who knows him well enough would say the same thing. In our talk with Bob today, we really get to talk and learn, again, more about his past, but also a lot of insight in terms of educating other clinicians and just even on personal subjects. He's a very, like I said, involved guy with our profession, and he shares with us a little bit about how he tries to balance that with family life. So a number of really nice things that we get to hear from Bob today. If you appreciate the conversation today with Bob, by all means, please like it on our website, as well as Twitter or Facebook. Share it with others, or also like it or write a review on iTunes if you don't mind. I would certainly appreciate that. That way we can spread the word about what we're doing and maybe get some more followers. So thank you as always for listening. We appreciate you guys as listeners. If you have any suggestions for us, by all means, drop us a line on Facebook, Twitter, email, the website, whatever. Whatever works for you. And we'll gladly appreciate it. So without further ado, here's Bob Rowe. Bob, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on the podcast here. It's a pleasure. I'm flattered to be here.
Well, the pleasure is ours. Bob, can you start off just by telling us a little bit of background, you know, where you're from, where you grew up?
Yeah, so I grew up in New York on Long Island, and lived there for a good part of my early life up until college. I started college up there, and then while I was in college doing prereqs for PT school, I moved to Louisiana, and then went to PT school in Louisiana at LSU Health Science Center in New Orleans, and graduated from there in 1985. It was a bachelor's degree back then, mm-hmm. and so then lived in New Orleans, the total time. I lived there for 24 years, wow. And then eventually we were there, my wife and I and family were there for Katrina, and we were there for about a year after Katrina, and about 6 months after we decided, we probably need to start thinking about getting out of here, and so then we left. But depending on how this show goes, we can talk about that later. Growing up in New York was the mecca of the universe, and I'm a New Yorker at heart, and people who drive with me will confirm that I am a New Yorker.
So, well, it's pretty funny that the times that I've either met you or talked to you or heard you speak, I'm sitting there saying to myself, gosh, that guy, he's got an accent, but I thought he was from Louisiana or something. So I never knew you were from New York.
Yeah. Well, you're exactly right. And so a lot of people, because it seems like it got tempered in New Orleans, when people who know the accents will always guess that I'm from Boston. Mm. But you know, I guess it's just, again, how the New York accent was eventually tempered by the influence of New Orleans. And now Florida's very flat. There is no accents here.
Yeah. Yeah, myself, I grew up in South Carolina, and, you know, I used to have more of an accent, but somewhere along the way, it kind of went down and down, and just it's not as much there anymore, unless, you know, certain situations come up, I guess.
Yeah, I wouldn't have guessed that. I know your background in South Carolina, but I didn't. I wouldn't have guessed it from hearing you speak.
Right. Yeah, I've heard that a bunch too. Well, Bob, you know, you started out and grew up on, did you say Long Island?
Yep, correct.
Okay. How did you get influenced to want to be a PT?
Yeah, so I think like a lot of PTs, you know, I was, I ended up getting injured while playing football, you know, high school football, and I injured my knee, and all of a sudden had to go to this thing called physical therapy that I had heard of, you know, because of other teammates and friends having to go get physical therapy, but still had no idea what it was. I was just, you know, oblivious to it. And then all of a sudden I had to go and I went for physical therapy, and it was just like, oh my gosh, this is unbelievable. I can't believe what these guys are doing. And like this, it was just it was the epiphany at that moment of this is amazing. I am so excited by this. And you know what? I think this is what I want to do.
Oh, wow.
Up until then, my dad was an electrician, and I didn't necessarily want to be an electrician, so I always thought, well, I'll be an electrical engineer. And really for as long as I can remember, I always said when people asked, what are you going to do when you grow up? I'd say, I'm going to be an electrical engineer. And then when I hurt my knee, all of a sudden it created some angst, you know, to my plan of, okay, well, what are you going to do? And, it's somewhat true, but somewhat of a joke. I always tell people that, you know, a lot of the prerequisites are very similar. You know, it's science-based, and, you know, so you still got to take biologies and English and history and physics and math and you know, for both programs. And you know, even that was heavily weighted towards the physical therapy. You know, I still kind of had the engineering thing because, you know, that was a lifelong expectation that I was going to do that. And then I always tell people it was that second calculus-based physics that pushed me over to the PT side.
Well, I would certainly understand that. I'm sure a lot of people would agree with you, too.
So, and again, it's partially a joke, but partially true.
Okay.
I'm glad that I ended up taking that path because, as you know, I'm sure you talk to lots and lots of people, and I feel the same way that so many people do, that I wouldn't change it for the world. There isn't anything on the planet that I would rather be doing than, you know, have this path of physical therapy. It's just been the most rewarding, exciting. I feel vibrant. I feel alive every day. And I, you know, I'm one of those people. I'm one of the lucky few that, you know, on Sunday night when everybody's carrying on and complaining about having to go to work on Monday morning, I just sit there and keep my mouth shut because I'm saying inside, oh, I can't wait for Monday to get to work, you know, and that doesn't take away from my family, because anybody who knows me from Facebook knows that, you know, we love to have fun and we do all kinds of great things and we have a great time together. But, I also enjoy being a physical therapist and coming to work every day and doing what I do. I've always loved it. I mean, from the first day I started working, I've been in love with it. You know, my wife will joke and say, Bob has a mistress, and people at first are like, take it back. And it's like, yeah, I know it's his work. You know, it's particularly advocacy. You know, she says, that's my mistress.
Well, that's a great kind of lead into one of the questions I had, because yes, I follow you on Facebook, and for anybody else that does, they have to admit you're the king of the selfies.
But so, well, the student assembly was very, very kind, and they gave me a name, the APTA student assembly, a couple of years ago. Kayla was the president, And she gave me a hashtag, hashtag selfie gone row.
Well, there you
go. So it's a, and so that's the hashtag where people post their selfies, and that's where I post my selfies. And now it seems like there's other people using that to post their selfies as well.
Well, I have to make sure I do that then.
Good.
Well, Bob, I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, I just said I certainly welcome all selfies.
Good. One of the questions I wanted to ask about, though, that you're certainly on social media, really enjoy spending time with your family, and it looks like going to Disney World. But how do you find the balance between spending time with family and all the different things that you do, whether it's the local state chapter, national chapter APTA, or even the academy when you were president of it? How do you find the balance between those things?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a common question that I get, because I enjoy being involved with professional service activities, and I enjoy the work that I do, and I love my family, and I love spending time with my family, and what we've grown to understand and appreciate that, the concept of, we work hard, we play hard, and it's not about the quantity of time. It's about the quality of time. That, we all acknowledge, everybody in my family acknowledges, that I don't spend as much time at home as some other people, but the time that I'm home is, we make it a point to be high quality time. People may be home in every evening, the mom and dad are home and the kids are home and everybody's at home, so they're all together, but they're all doing their own thing. They all have their own little laptops and iPads and iPhones and TVs, and everybody's in different corners of the room doing different things.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of quantity there in terms of time, relative time spent together, but it's not quality time, quality family time. And so that's where we've learned to make things count and balance it out, that we make sure that when I'm home, we really spend quality time enjoying each other's company and focusing on the relationship building and just doing fun things. So
okay,
that's how we balance it. That's what's worked for us.
When you're you're away, or even when you are home, do you have any kind of set routines or things that you go through?
No, you know what? I don't. I'm not a very routine oriented person, to be honest. I'm not good with routines. I prefer to change things up and do things a little bit differently. My wife is a little bit more routine oriented, but then that still works out fine, because she follows her routine and I just kind of move in and out of it. We communicate a lot, though. Even when I'm away, we still communicate a lot. I'll still talk to my wife and daughter, probably commonly four times a day, even when I'm out of town.
That's great.
First thing in the morning, and then, while they're driving to school, or I'm, walking someplace, and then maybe at lunchtime, and then, when they get out of school, I'll try and step out and, give them a call and see how their day was. And then, before they go to bed at night, I call them and, tell them I love them and give them a kiss goodnight. So it's typically about four times a day.
Okay. Well, gosh, I'd love to learn a little bit more from you on that, but I think we could save that for a different time and just move on, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
So I kind of skipped over one part that I did want you to mention, because we talked about, where you're from and kind of your entrance into the physical therapy world. Can you give us a little update on currently what you're up to?
Yeah, so today I'm the executive director of the Brooks Institute of Higher Learning. Brooks is a not-for-profit health system located primarily in Jacksonville, Florida, and it's a health system, and it has really four major divisions. There's an inpatient rehab hospital, 157 beds, so it's It's about the second largest in the country. By volumes, it's anywhere from number one to three on any given day within the country. There's an outpatient division. We have 35 outpatient clinics of varying size. They all do musculoskeletal. Many of them offer multidisciplinary services for lots of different ages. So, you know, pediatrics, neurologics, OT, PT, speech. We have a aging adult division, which is we have two 100-bed SNFs and assisted living and two greenhouse dementia units. And then we have the home health division, which is fairly large. It goes all the way from here in North Florida down to the Ocala, Orlando region and all the way coast to coast pretty much here in Northern Florida. And so those are the four clinical divisions. And then the Institute of Higher Learning, the IHL, is the academic division of Brooks Rehab. And so that's my team. I'm the executive director of that group. And we oversee the and create opportunities for professional development and career development for all of our clinical staff. So for about 1,500 to 2,000 clinical staff members of all different backgrounds, you know, PT, OT, speech, nursing, psychology, neuropsych, case management, social workers, recreational therapists, so really the whole gamut.
That's quite a bit. Now, can you also update us on what you're currently doing with the APTA?
So currently I'm on the APTA Board of Directors as a director. Board of Directors has 15 members to it. There's the officers, which is the president, the vice president, the secretary and treasurer. Then there's two house officers, really three house officers. The secretary serves as both a house officer and then on the other group. And then the other nine are directors. And I'm serving as one of the directors on the APTA board.
Oh, wow. And
I'm in my I'm in the third year now of my first term, which means that I'm up for re-election this year.
Oh, okay. Are you going to be running again?
Well, you know, I would like to be. So the process is, first you have to be slated, and then you're slated by the nominating committee, the APTA nominating committee. And so if I'm fortunate enough to be slated, I am actively seeking to be slated. And if I'm slated, then I would accept and I would be thankful for the opportunity to run again for a second term.
Oh, great. Well, hopefully you'll get voted in. I wouldn't see why not.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's a great process, and it's I'll tell you right now that it's serving on the board is a honor and privilege. It's I think people look at it and they say, man, that's a lot of work, and that's, you know, I don't know how people do that, but at the end of the day, I'll tell you, every day I'm thankful for the opportunity to serve and to be, you know, collaborating with both my board colleagues and with staff, the APTA staff. And we have an amazing group right now. Both the APTA board, I think it's got some great chemistry to it. It's got some great combination of people who are great visionaries, people who are, people that are willing to roll up their sleeves and do some great work. And, you know, just people that have passion for the profession. And, you know, we have a great relationship with our APTA staff. Justin Moore is the CEO, and he's just, you know, been in that role for a little over a year. And he's just flipped this thing and just, you know, he's got staff just jumping up and down, doing great things. And so it's really, as I said this already, an honor and a privilege to be in this role. And I'm so thankful every day that I have a chance to serve, you know, the members and to do the things we need to do to make us relevant to society.
Oh, well, thanks. I didn't think I was going to mention it, but since you kind of brought up the board and everything and some of the officers, The next time you see or speak to Lisa Saladin, please tell her I said hello.
I will absolutely do that.
She was one of my professors, and even during school, before she got as involved as she is now in the APTA, it was just amazing to see kind of her work ethic and her drive. And she was a great teacher. I mean, we had a really good time learning neuroscience from her.
Yep. I have to agree. She's an amazing mentor, a role model. She's, I'm not sure if you heard this, but she's recently promoted to provost at MUSC.
Oh yes. Yeah.
Which is a remarkable leadership role. And to have a physical therapist in that level of leadership within a major university is really important for the profession. And so that because it really opens up paths and roads and opportunities for that to happen other places. So we're really thankful and blessed to have her serving in that role. And so
yeah, most definitely.
We had her here. We have what we call the IHL Scholarly Symposium, and she was our keynote this past year.
Yeah, I saw that. That was pretty cool to see. Just something else I'm impressed by.
She did a fantastic job.
Well, Bob, kind of moving on to our next subject. I know that you have a lot of training in manual therapy. You did a residency in Master of Orthopedic Manual Therapy with Ole Grimsby Institute, as well as your fellowship and Doctor of Manual Therapy. And you're a fellow in the American Academy and actually past president for a couple of terms. I mean, with all that kind of skill that you've attained, tell me about how you first got interested in manual therapy.
So that's a great question. I'm thankful that you asked that. Back when I was in PT school in 1985, manual therapy was still just kind of coming around, where people were recognizing it and not considering it to be like voodoo or, you know, like PTs wanting to be chiropractors. There was some ugly history there, yeah, you know, within the physical therapy world when it came to manual therapy for a few years. And I was right on the cusp. I was coming out of that when I was graduating. We were coming out of that kind of bad time, and it was really not many people knew it. Not, you know, very few people were trained in it. And in fact, in my PT school, we had one day of manual therapy where Dr. Joe McCulloch from the Shreveport campus flew down, spent a day with us, teaching us manual therapy techniques. Mm-hmm. Yep. And that was our exposure to manual therapy. And, so it just seemed like something that was just a fit. I don't know. It's from the first time he started talking about it, and Joe was, you know, teaching us some techniques, and it was just like, you know, this is pretty interesting stuff. I don't know. It just feels good. You know, I kind of like this. And then one of the first courses I did out of school was a Syriac course, you know, shoulder, knee, neck course. And every time I would go to another manual therapy course, I just felt, you know what, that just feels a little bit better. It feels a little bit more comfortable. And then in 1988, I went to my first course with Ola, and that was another talk about epiphany. That created a huge paradigm shift for me, because he was somebody who was amazingly brilliant, who had one of the most well-read people that I've ever known, could cite literature, like we were talking about a newspaper article from yesterday and talking about an article from 50 years ago, and not just one, but just a volume of information that he had in his brain, who was able to speak eloquently and really challenge you and hold you accountable, you know, not just, it wasn't fluffy. You know, back in the old days, you were warned ahead of time, look, manual therapy, the teachers are mean. And they're gonna ask you questions, and they're gonna, you know, tell you no, you're wrong, and they're gonna, you know, whatever. And I didn't find anybody to be mean, but I did find them to be very strong-willed and held people to a high level of accountability and had high expectations that you were going to do this the right way, and you no sloppiness. There's no like horseshoes playing here. You know, you either get a ringer or you don't, you keep working on it. And that was very enticing to me, and it continued to draw me in. And then a few years later, I went to an exercise dosing, what Ola calls STEP. Mm-hmm. And again, another paradigm changing experience for me, really understanding like, so why does everybody do 3 sets of 10? You know, why, and you know, do we exercise things other than, you know, why aren't we exercising other tissues besides muscle? They all thrive on stress. And we have really good basic science literature that talks about the importance of stressing the connective tissues and how they thrive on appropriate optimal loading. And so why aren't we dealing with that? Why aren't we talking about that in PT? And so I just kept, you know, the more exposure I got, the more it drew me towards it. And again, there weren't many programs. There weren't many residency programs. In fact, there weren't any residency programs. They were what we call today fellowship, but they were calling themselves residency because we didn't know any better. It was just the nomenclature of the time. Yeah. And there were literally 7 of them that existed in the whole country. And so finally, by the time it was 1995, I was able to put together enough people to have a course, get what they referred to back then as part one, which was really what we would refer to today as a residency. Mm-hmm. And we did a part one in New Orleans, and then I did graduate from that. And then ended up doing the part two, which was the fellowship, what we call today a fellowship. And that was 4 years of training back then. So now it's compressed into 2 today, but back then it was 4 years.
Wow. Wow, that sounds, I mean, pretty fascinating. And just your passion and gratefulness to learn all the things that you did from somebody like Ola.
Yeah, I was fortunate. You know, it's I always think I've been really, really fortunate throughout my life. And I wish I could step back and say, you know, look, I planned all that out and I created a beautiful vision and I knew exactly what I was going to do and how I was going to do it. And at the end of the day, you know, particularly those first years were very, unstructured and, a series of coincidences that led to very positive outcomes. And so attending a course in the first place was a great opportunity, and then just one after the other, just one opportunity after the other, just a chance meeting of somebody and a conversation, and that's the story of my life. Yeah. You know, is just opportunities just presenting themselves. And I guess the thing that I would say that I did was I recognized them as an opportunity and I took advantage of them at that moment in time. Because I guess there's times it would have been easy just to ignore it or, you know, kind of blow it off and not really recognize it for what it potentially was. But I did. I recognized when those things kind of fell in my lap, I looked at it and said, oh, you know what, this could be something. And I took advantage of it.
Well, following up on that, Bob, was there ever a time where you recognized something as an opportunity, but you didn't really want to do it and you just did it anyway, you know, despite, you know, not wanting to? Is there any instance that happened?
There was a time that an opportunity came open and I really didn't want to, and I actively didn't pursue it. But thank God somebody else forced me to pursue it. because it was again another one of those life changing events that I just got lucky. I had left. I was in a private practice, a corporate model private practice, small model in New Orleans, and an opportunity came open at LSU Health Science. It was about 7 years after I graduated, maybe 6-7 years after I graduated from PT school. And I'd been out primarily in outpatient orthopedics, you know, doing outpatient orthopedics. and a position came open at LSU within their faculty practice as the director. And so I applied for that position. I was fortunate to get that position as the director of the faculty practice that was embedded within the LSU PT department. And so after about 10 months, a faculty member left and left their faculty position. And at that point, I was recruited to move into that faculty position. And at that point, I was really happy being, working in the clinic, being the director of the clinic. I loved what I was doing. In my mind, I always felt and thought of myself as a clinician. To this day, I always say I'm just a simple clinician. And I really believe that in my heart. That's not just something I say. I really believe it. And that's really what I've always wanted to be, was a clinician. From the time I decided to be a PT, I always felt like no matter what, I'm going to be a clinician.
Yeah.
And when this faculty position came open, I really wasn't interested in it. I was happy to give some spot lectures. I was happy to help out with some labs, and which I had been doing for that previous year. But I really didn't want to move into a core faculty position. And before I knew it, that's what I was doing. So over like a, I don't know, 6-week period, I went from being the director of the clinic to being a core PT faculty member. And it really wasn't something that I wanted to pursue and had no intention of pursuing it. And in fact, had been oppositional to pursuing it. But there I was doing it. And I felt like maybe I was a little shanghaied or something. And but you know what? That opportunity, that flipped so many things for me. Again, it gave me a passion and a love for teaching that I'd never experienced before. And so that was a great experience for me and taught me a lesson that, you know, you do need to be open-minded when opportunities come open that, you know, it may not always appear to be the best thing, but you gotta give it, you know, be open-minded and give it a shot.
Yeah, well, that's a great story to tell too. I really, really appreciate hearing that. Bob, you mentioned earlier that you had a couple of mentors along the way, one of the main ones being Ola Grimsby. Have you had any other mentors in your career in terms of manual therapy or just physical therapy?
Yeah, you know, the scary part of that is that I would that I'm afraid of leaving somebody out because there's been so many. There's been just a great number of people that have either been formal mentors and some of that lasts for an extended period of time, but some of that is almost like and they might not even know that they were a mentor. Mm. You know, because it happened so quickly, like, and their interaction with me was relatively short, but it was a game changer.
Hmm.
And so, you know, people like Rick Hobush out in Salt Lake City was a, he's a clinician within the OGI system. And, one of the most brilliant, clinicians that I know is he's amazing. You know, I know you had Lori Hartman on your show and Lori has, I've never worked with Lori, never practiced, but I've taken his course. I think I'm a Lori Hartman, Lori Hartman groupie, because I've gone to so many of his courses and,
yeah,
he's really been a tremendous influence on me, from a practice standpoint. Steve McDavid, more from a professional standpoint, was really the first person to start recruiting me to get involved with APTA type things. I had been involved with the academy, with AAMT, within the standards committee as a reviewer, as a site reviewer for the early programs, and then eventually moved into a more formal role on the standards committee, and including being chair of that committee. Preceding my other formal leadership roles with AAMT. And at the same time, along a parallel path, I had met Steve McDavid at an AAMT conference, and he was the chair of the Orthopedic Sections Practice Committee, which is a board position for the orthopedic section. And he, him and I met at a continuing ed course, the post-conference AAMT course, and we were partners, and we just hit it off, and he said, hey, you know, would you be interested in joining the committee? And I said, well, you know, that'd be great. I'd love to do that. So he worked it out and got me an appointment onto the committee. And then all of a sudden he was moving off that committee. And so he appointed me vice chair of the committee. And then I eventually, when he moved off the, as chair of the committee, I became the chair of the committee. And, so there were a couple of things where I followed in his footsteps. Mm-hmm. Another group was APOP, the Advisory Panel on Practice, which was an APTA board advisory panel that they used to have. They don't have those anymore. But again, that was a position he was in. When he got elected to the APTA board, he vacated the position, and I got appointed into that position on the APOP group, the Advisory Panel on Practice, okay. And eventually went on to serve as chair of that group. He was a great, Steve McDavid was a great mentor for me along that path. Within the academic realm was Dave Parisar, was a great mentor for me. Dave unfortunately passed away a few years ago while he was serving on APTA Board of Directors. But he was on faculty at LSU when I was kind of shanghaied into that position. And he really took me under his wing and helped mold me into, you know, a teacher, you know, help me move from being a, you know, presenter, you know, somebody who could stand up and talk and present information to really being a teacher of information. Because those are really two very, very different things. Like if you go to courses, you'll be able to figure that out. You go to and you hear and somebody's really entertaining, but you walk out and you really don't remember much about what they said versus somebody, you finish the course and you walk out and you retain that information. And you know, that's the difference between a presenter and a teacher.
So do you have any things that you learned in how to be a good teacher versus just a presenter?
Yeah, you know, it's all about relationship and making the touch points and, you know, building rapport with an individual, whether it's an audience or an individual within that audience. And, you know, having that contact, you know, with that person. And, you know, the idea, you know, that's very, very powerful is storytelling, you know, the concept of storytelling and getting people to, you know, buy in. And there's something from a neurophysiologic standpoint that they've studied that demonstrates that when you can tie it into a story, the retention is much, much greater. You know, think about, you know, the stories being told for, you know, 10, 20,000 years around the campfire that I got passed down generation to generation about, you know, how to do things. And those stories, in many cases, were, you know, how to live life. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just a story for entertainment. They were telling a story, but the story was to help you understand how you were supposed to do something. And so I think the art of storytelling is very, very important to teaching and helping people retain information. And I think the other point that I said already was, that rapport, you know, if people feel safe and they feel like you're not trying to, belittle them and you're not trying to make them look bad and you really are, you have their best interest in mind. So it's a safe, nurturing environment. They're more likely to learn something.
Oh, good advice for that, for sure. Bob, as we kind of keep going here, I'll ask a couple more questions and then we might get into a little bit more rapid fire things, but okay. What are some things that?
Yeah, sorry, my answers are kind of long. I apologize.
No, not at all. It's perfect. That's what I want. No, you're doing great so far. What are some of the things that you hope younger clinicians learn from you or take away from their time with you?
You know, I think that there's a couple of things. One, life is precious. And it's short. Sometimes when we're young, we kind of think, you know, we have a bazillion years and we have, you know, the rest of our life and, you know, you have so much time and, you know, so I've lived that and I get that. But when you start getting on this side of the aisle, all of a sudden you realize, you know what, it wasn't quite as long as I thought it was. And, you know, so work hard to accomplish what you want to accomplish because you're not going to have as much time as you think you have. I think setting goals and working towards your goals, prioritizing components of your life, like family and friends and, you know, whatever work you're doing. Find your passion. You know, if you have passion and you work doing something that you enjoy, you've never worked a day in your life.
Yeah.
So I'm throwing out a bunch of cliches right now, but those are all, I think, really valuable things to live by. And one of the ones that I think is most important, and I try and remind people of this all the time, you know, life is so precious and so valuable and so short, and we should be doing everything we can to make other people's lives easier, not harder. We should be trying to understand other people. We should be trying to appreciate other people. We should be trying to help other people, support other people, engaging other people, collaborating with other people. We spend a lot of time fighting and trying to separate from each other and look for differences. And I feel like we should be looking for similarities. We should be looking for what are opportunities to work together and collaborate so that we can be synergistic, rather than working on like what are our differences. So those are things that I hope, and I hope the people, the young people, and whoever they are that I'm working with, they recognize my passion, you know, for what we're doing, and that with, you know, and where, what I'm trying to do and where we're trying to go, that it's not, you know, this is not about Bob Rowe. This is about how can we make the world a better place? And that's always the way I've approached it. And the last thing, I guess, and then I'll stop is as a physical therapist, regardless of what role I've ever been in, I try to say, how does this make things better for patients? So whether I'm in my current role as the executive director of the IHL and I'm making decisions about, you know, residencies and continuing ed and, you know, all the different things, the professional development opportunities that we provide to the staff here and for the community, whether it's making decisions on the APTA board, there's always a algorithm that leads back to, how is this going to impact patients and society? And you know what? If it's not going to have a positive impact, then we need to figure out another way of doing it, because that's not the right path. So that's my world that I live in.
Well,
and I hope that's what people get from me.
Well, you can certainly apply that to personal lives as well as professional lives, because there's a lot of wisdom in that and in those things that you just said. So thank you for that. And you actually just kind of answered my next question, so I don't even have to ask that. It's just basically, you know, what do you hope people remember about you over time? And, you know, you answered it, so that's great.
Yeah, if you don't mind, I'll add one more thing to that, though. You know, there's a poem called The Dash. And if you haven't seen that, I would strongly recommend you go look it up. And the dash is, you know, if you think about a tombstone and somebody was born this date and they died this date, in between is the dash, and that's your life. Mm. And so what is your dash going to be like when you finally, you know, when it's time to go home and you're under the ground and you got a tombstone there, what is your dash going to look like? You know, and that's, again, another how I think. What is your dash going to be?
Oh, perfect. I'll have to look that up then, because I haven't heard of that before. Bob, next question for you. It's kind of, how do I follow up on that? It's just, you know, there's so many great things that you just said. I feel like anything else that I ask or say is just going to be a letdown for people listening. But what is either the best and or worst advice that you've heard given to other people, or that you've even given yourself?
Oh, goodness. So the best, I think, you know, things in there are, be true to yourself. Be, be honest and open and transparent. I think those are pieces of advice. You know, one of the things my dad taught me early on was a bit of advice he gave me was I was a little upset and I hadn't made the baseball team, and I made a statement, well, you know, at least I was better than so-and-so because I made it further in the cuts than he did. And my dad said, you know, each of us tries as hard as we can and we do the best we can. And so in that sense, you're not better or worse than anybody. You're just as good as you can be.
Yeah.
And I think that was a great piece of advice that my dad gave me, so that I really have stopped. I don't judge myself compared to other people. I don't look at other people and judge them and make decisions, you know, versus regarding what they're doing. I think to myself, how am I behaving and how am I doing and what is the best thing? Am I doing as well as I could do? And if not, then what do I need to do to change that?
Yeah.
The worst advice, I'm sure that I've heard, you know, horrible things and and bad advice, but I repress that so quickly that I'm having a hard time remembering anything.
Well, that's okay. You don't have to. It's just kind of one of those questions you throw out there and see what people come back with. But I can kind of affirm the good advice that your dad gave you. I don't know if you call it advice, but I remember growing up and my dad telling me and, you know, my brother, don't ever think that you're better than somebody else.
Yeah.
But don't ever think that somebody is better than you.
Yeah.
Yep. So it kind of goes both ways, you know. What you were saying too, that's what reminded me of it. Now, I always kind of keep that in mind. Think about that.
Yeah, I think your dad was a smart guy.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Bob, so moving along still, since you've been in so many different leadership roles, if you could challenge other people in your profession to something, whether it's to do something, be something, you know, whatever, what would you choose and why?
So I think people should be champions for our patients. You know, the patients deserve that, and they don't know necessarily what to do or how to do it, and we do. And so I really believe it's our responsibility to be the patient champion. And so when you think about advocacy, it's really easy to make it self-centered or make it about us. But again, I think people need to be involved in advocacy, and they need to do it for the right reason. They need to do it because they're advocating for the patient, and not for self-serving interests. And it just goes back to who I am and my core of why I believe that it's not about trying to make myself, you know, more wealthy or trying to make myself more powerful or trying to make anything for myself. It's about, you know, we're here on this earth for a relatively short period of time. We should make the best of it to try and make things better for everybody else who we can.
Yeah, good. Great to hear. Now, for our next question, Bob, this goes back to being in the clinical role. If you could treat only one part of the body or area or region of the body for pretty much everybody who walks in the door as a patient, you know, any commonalities that you see in terms of dysfunctions or things that could benefit from manual treatment using any kind of technique possible, what would you pick?
That's easy, the spine. That's what I've done for the majority of my career.
Any particular part of the spine, like one region or the whole thing?
Well, that's a great question. I'm thankful that you asked it because, you know, I believe that the spine is a functional unit and that it's completely artificial. Whenever we try and separate it, we try and say, well, whether it's through a continuing ed course or a module in a classroom, or a patient who comes in and somebody says, well, the patient's coming in and they have neck pain. I think it's an absolute complete farce to think that you're treating their cervical spine. I think that it's, when somebody comes in, they may have pain in a particular region of their spine, but they have a spinal problem. It's a functional unit, and you can't impact one spot of that without having an impact on the entire thing. And I'm generalizing. I mean, obviously somebody could have a traumatic injury and have an injury to one point, and then if you treat that person within a few minutes, you know, that's true. But the reality is, because of the structure of the spine, because of the intricacy of the muscular system, the neurophysiology of it, the fascial system, when you put the whole system together, it's a functional unit, and you can't separate them. So if you have somebody with a relative pathology, even that's biased towards a region, it's going to impact the other regions. And I think the mistake that people make when they treat the spine is that they only treat the region where they think the pain is. And that's why people end up failing, you know, or not getting, and maybe that's a strong statement, not getting the success that they would have gotten if they had looked at it from a different perspective.
Well, it goes back to focus on function versus pain. Don't chase pain.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Great advice there. Now, we're kind of wrapping up, so maybe one more last question and then we'll finish up, if that's okay with you.
Yes, sir.
Kind of along the same lines, instead of actually treating through manual therapy techniques or anything like that, but if you could only teach one thing to every patient who comes in the door, if you could just teach them one thing, what would it be and why?
You know, that's a great question. So the importance of them recognizing that they have control of this, they have control of the problem.
Yeah.
They have control over the fact that it came in the first place. They have control over how it's going to progress and what their ultimate prognosis is going to be. They really are the determinants for that. It's based on them and how they tried to do that. So I guess that's the most important thing, is teaching them their responsibility and that they own this, and that we're here to help them. We can guide them. We can motivate them. We can coach them. We can teach them. But it's ultimately, at the end of the day, their responsibility, and they need to take ownership of it.
That's perfect. I don't think you could have picked a better answer, in my opinion, so far. Well,
thank you.
Bob, gosh, you know, any time I talk to people on here, it just seems to fly by, and it's flown by again. I'd love to chat with you some more in the future and get to talk about some other things. But for now, thanks a lot for joining us and giving us your time. We really, really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very, very much. I really do appreciate the opportunity to chat with you. Enjoyed visiting, and I would certainly welcome the chance to come back and talk again. There's probably a few more things we could talk about.
Oh, definitely. Well, Bob, how can people learn more about you or what you're doing, whether it's with the Brooks Rehab or the IHL or even the APTA? Is there any place that they can go to learn more about those things?
Yep, so they can go to the Brooks website. It's brooksihl.org, and they can follow me on Twitter on Twitter. it's RRO 62. Mm-hmm. And Facebook, it's I believe it's Bob Rowe, but that'll be pretty easy to figure out. You see my ugly mugs on the picture there. I think those are the primary ways of identifying me.
Okay.
My email, if people want to email me, you can email me at robert.rowe@brookshealth.org. B-R-O-O-K-S, health.org.
Great. All right. Well, anything else, Bob?
No, thank you so much. I really do appreciate this, Matt. It was great talking to you.
Oh, no, pleasure's mine. We'll look forward to either seeing you in the future or chatting with you another time.
Great. Look forward to it.
All right. Well, have a great day. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you very much. All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.